Hey, how are you guys doing? Welcome to the Cave and Devani Connection Show. You know, I've always found it fascinating when people come from, you know, conventional professions or mainstream journalism or any other field, and, you know, they go deep down rabbit hole for whatever time. And, you know, and there's already a bunch of, you know, good articles and books and publications. But when somebody like John Tinkelenberg comes out of nowhere and starts researching and intends, you know, to write a book about it, about Bitcoin, I'm always, you know, curious, like, what's the process? What is the vision? What kind of values do they adhere to Bitcoin? What do they see in Bitcoin? What kind of hopes, visions, dreams? What kind of solutions do they see in Bitcoin? So the process of, you know, of understanding, of comprehending, of transferring also this knowledge, it's really fascinating to me. So without further ado, this is my talk with John Tinkelenberg. Really looking forward to that. And make sure you follow me on Twitter, subscribe to YouTube channel and podcast platforms. And yeah, hope you're going to enjoy this. I'll see you soon again. Hey, John, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you bet. John, I mean, you came out of nowhere, if I may start like that. You came out of nowhere into the Bitcoin space. Why don't you tell a little bit about yourself, my listeners? I think we're really, really curious where you're from and how did you get into Bitcoin?
Okay. Well, a little bit about me is I'm a reporter by trade. I went to school for journalism at Elon University here in America. And I went the newspaper route. I was a reporter for a little while and working on the political beat, primarily local government, a little bit of state and federal elections, but it's a great career if you love being in the center of the conversation of all times. But there are always those ethical dilemmas, you know, because people, it's very easy to mislead, and a lot of people, they think that like the media has a liberal bias, which I kind of have a unique take on that. I think it's pretty natural when you kind of see how everybody lives, more or less, because there's that saying that one half doesn't know how the other half lives. And so kind of the huge mechanics behind it, I decided to leave traditional journalism. And since then, I've kind of taken a meandering path to marketing. And I was doing that when COVID-19 came out of nowhere, and like the rest of us, just kind of flipped everything upside down. And I was fortunate enough in that I could work from home. And I, you know, there were no sports, there were no concerts, not really a whole lot of TV. And you could still read books, at least, you know, I don't think they found out about that yet. And I just started, you know, look, I was sitting there saying, look, if I'm just going to sit here, I might as well get paid. And so I started looking at investing, and I didn't go the full on Robin Hood route, although I've subscribed to Wall Street Bets for years. It's just funny to see how everybody thinks. And so I came to investing and into Bitcoin through Lynn Alden. Her newsletter and her service is fantastic.
Yeah, she's brilliant. She's a brilliant brain. Bitcoin. I mean, I'm always like in admiration of her. She's like, I don't know how she developed her knowledge or intelligence, but she's amazing.
Yeah, one of the sharpest writers I've ever seen. And so she started talking about it, and that's when I fell down the rabbit hole. And I don't think I've ever come out of, maybe I've come out the other side, who knows? So I came to Bitcoin as a noob and started studying it. I've listened to so many podcasts, read so many books. I started hodling in May last year. Great time to get in, of course. And you know, I'm one of those people where the blob has consumed me, and I'm at a point now where it's like, how can I give back to the blob? So what I'm working on right now is when I kind of thought about the last year, is that I can see a pretty strong story arc here from COVID-19 being this call to adventure, everything changes, to where I'm looking at Bitcoin and all of the events of the last year through kind of a first-person narrative, like a Hunter S. Thompson book. He wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and studied Hell's Angels through a first-person lens that it's not the traditional, the mainstream way, but like I believe he tries to capture the spirit of the movement. And that's what I'm trying to do. And so I started reaching out to people, and thankfully Corey Clipston at Swan Bitcoin was really helpful setting this up today. And so I'm planning on going to Bitcoin 2021 because I see that it being kind of like this Woodstock level moment for what has been an incredible year for Bitcoin. And so, yeah, that's a long-winded answer, but that's how I got here.
Yeah, super exciting. Now, I wish I could go to Miami in June, but, you know, we have my girlfriend and I have a 3-month old baby girl. So it's a lot, mm-hmm. you know, and then we have to move and to the more countryside. But I wish we could meet one day. So, John, you said you're working on, if I may mention that, you're working on a book, right? Sort of is work in progress.
Right.
Like, is it about Bitcoin Renaissance? Is that like the working title?
The working title I have right now is All Your Models Are Destroyed, that famous quote from Saylor. Because that's kind of how I see this working out. I mean, COVID-19 flipped everything on its head, dematerialized so many things. I mean, it used to be if you and I wanted to chat, we could, you know, call long distance or maybe I could fly there. And now here we are on Zoom, which I'd never really even used Zoom before all of this started. And so I see this as this kind of generational moment where everything has changed. And when you look at COVID-19 and the response of the money printing and all of the stimulus, it's kind of it's a cause and effect. It's pretty clear to me. I'm not an economist. I'm not a developer, but, you know, I'm just a guy and that's the way I see it. I'm looking at this renaissance from kind of a little bit of a historical perspective, although not as much as say Breedlove or Alan Farrington, because frankly, they're way smarter than I am. But I'm looking at it as like a culture, a revolution, and trying to distill in, you know, 300, 400 pages, just what it's like to be in this moment in time.
Okay, let's go down the rabbit hole. When you say, I'm just paraphrasing you, but I think you got in touch with Bitcoin, you went into the rabbit hole, and I don't want to put words into your mouth, but do you see like structural problems? What are the structural, because this is what really fascinates me right now, because there's so much structural issues we have, whether it be the central banks or, you know, self-elected entities with criminal immunity. This is what really fascinates me. It's like the big elephant in the room, not to mention, you know, nation states, governments, military industrial complex, you know, and everything around it. It's so mind-boggling if you think about it. What do you see in Bitcoin that can like structurally transform everything, our whole human civilization? When you talk about, you know, Renaissance, for example. I mean, what would the Renaissance of human civilization mean to you?
Well, I think that in a way, since 2008, there has been a lot of smoke and mirrors coming out of the financial system as it exists. When I was 16, I worked at a pizza restaurant here in North Carolina. I made $7.25 an hour. It was minimum wage here in 2008. That wage has not changed at all. The minimum wage here is still $7.25. And since that time, the Fed has printed more than $11 trillion. And that's more money than even existed back then. And so we're talking about an entire generation, my millennial generation and Gen Z, to where our future has just been robbed from us. And, you know, I actually think that America, the Constitution, it has tremendous promise. It's a wonderful system and so many great checks and balances and freedoms and rights. I think that we're missing a fundamental component, and that is sound money. I don't think the founding fathers, when they drafted the Constitution, they had this notion that we could someday have a true hard asset. And so if you don't have that, you end up with the psychological, but just human nature. Human nature takes over, and politicians just, they borrow and print. And I think until we kind of get back on a true hard money Bitcoin standard, the unrest is just going to get worse. And so many of the problems right now you see are because we're trusting in the wrong thing. Like the US dollar says, in God we trust. And I think it says that because it sure as shit ain't numbers. So yeah, that's kind of my take.
Now there are some positive developments. I used to live like 5 years in California, and I used to say, you know, everything that's like really innovative, like advancing things, progressive, or, you know, something, a new development, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it, or sometimes most of it, it depends what we're talking about, comes from the United States. All right. It's a really great country, you know, and, and, you know, yes, you know, there's the Constitution, there's the Bill of Rights, there's, you know, the founding fathers, there's the principles, the ethical principles, but it's been hijacked, John. There's some positive developments now with, you know, Senator Cynthia Lummis, or what's his name, Congressman Warren Davidson, and, you know, Ron Paul and his son. These are like the libertarians, right? These are the, I would call them the ethical politicians, the ethical decision makers, but they don't have that much leverage at the moment. But do you think it's gaining momentum?
I see it gaining momentum. I mean, the sheer number of people that are getting into it. Once I started getting into Bitcoin, just asking around, so many people on the street that I talk to, they're like, oh yeah, I have Bitcoin. And maybe they probably aren't as into it as I am, but they at least see that, yeah, there's some merit there. And I think pretty much anybody you talk to, they say, hey, look, yeah, Bitcoin may have been a fad the first time or the second time, but fads don't come around three times. So I think this is fundamentally different. And it's like before COVID, all I knew about Bitcoin was that a lot of people made a lot of money of it. And I think I heard some story about a guy that made so much money, he hired somebody to dig a tunnel under his house and the tunnel collapsed.
Really?
Yeah. I forget where that story was, but perhaps it was an urban legend or something like that. But that was all I knew about Bitcoin before COVID, because it wasn't until COVID-19, I was sitting on 60 Minutes watching Neil Kashkari saying, you know, don't worry, everything's fine. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, we have infinite cash.
Those words. It's unbelievable. I mean,
yeah, infinite cash.
Sometimes I'm like, you know, scrupulous or non-scrupulous, you know, they have no scruples anymore. It's like in our face. It's, you know, whether you take the World Economic Forum or Bill Gates, it's like, you know, they're telling us in our face. It's like, you know, as if they wanted to tell us, you know, we're going to execute this agenda, and afterwards we're going to tell you, we told you so. You know, sometimes it seems to me a little really like crazy, really crazy.
I agree. And I think I don't necessarily think that these people are evil. I try not to attribute to malice what is easily explainable by stupidity. And the reality is they're still working with the same tools from 30, 40 years ago. The idea that we could just print fiat money indefinitely. And that rose up in an age before the internet. And I mean, there's no reason that a transaction should take 2 days to settle. It's ridiculous. And meanwhile, Bitcoin settles in 10 minutes. It's just no comparison.
Is there something, John, that really concerns you when you think about, you know, I mean, you know, we finally, I think most people, I think, have figured out, even in the mainstream, that Bitcoin cannot be banned. It cannot be stopped. The cat is out of the bag. Pandora's box has been open like since 12 years now. In the monetary revolution, it's been declared like what, dead for like 350, 400 times. So it's over. The game is over. We're going into the already actually in the process of hyperbitcoinization. But are there like, is there any like a process where you think this could be a problem? I mean, you know, when it comes to freedom, you know, or moving, you know, I mean, look at the lockdown, the vaccination, the European Court of Human Rights just declared in their newest whatever verdict that it's totally okay to have compulsory mandatory vaccination. Unbelievable. But, you know, do you see where I'm going with this? I mean, do you see any problem along this path?
When it comes to Bitcoin, and obviously it's a public ledger, I think there are two things that I worry the most about it. One of them being I think that one day governments will try to levy property taxes upon it, similar to how they do with real estate. And I'm okay with some taxes. You know, I'm okay with paying a little bit of money and having some services performed. I'm not okay with just being taxed to oblivion. I think the second thing I kind of worry about, and I don't necessarily think this is a threat, but I think that this is a case where there's a mismatch between the perception and reality. You've probably seen a lot of people talking about the climate change component. And I think that that's a tough narrative to win with people, because I think energy is everything, and we use it for so many different purposes. And I think it's a bit unfair to really characterize Bitcoin as a poor use of energy. But a lot of people, they say, you know, oh, these miners are burning energy. That's bad. But I've never seen anybody question driving someplace in a car if they really want to go there. It's kind of a case where we're all okay with using our energy, but we're not okay with other people using energy. They can do it. They can figure some other way out. But I think that the Bitcoin community as a whole, we need to kind of really have a strong defense for climate change that's succinct and easy for people to understand. And I mean, there are a lot of great people that are working on that right now. And Nick Carter's been putting a lot of good stuff out there explaining that, like, look, you know, if anything, gathering energy, encrypting it, and having Bitcoin is almost like a unit of energy and time is a powerful thing. And at least it can't be gamified or completely made up by somebody in Washington. So I think that's something that I kind of worry about a little bit. I think it's easy for the media to pick on Bitcoin because of that. And that's probably more of a concern of mine than necessarily government banning it. Because I just don't think the government has its act together. We kind of saw what happened with COVID. They're slow to move, slow to act. And you brought up a really good point earlier about America and politicians, some politicians really getting involved with Bitcoin, like Cynthia Lummis. And I know Patrick McHenry, who was the congressman where I grew up, he kind of took an interesting step and started hosting a white paper on his site. And I think that there are a lot of really smart people that are looking at this and seeing the future. It's a small minority right now, but I think that's pretty indicative of where the population is. As far as the rest of the country and the world as well, it's kind of, I think it's hard to let go of something that we think is working. It's part of why startups come up and overtake the big players. There's a little bit of perceived career risk in this. And obviously I'm here right now because I don't believe that's the case. And I think time will bear this out.
Yeah, and what the, you know, all this FUD is concerned, you know, as you said, you know, not only Nick Carter, but there's so many brilliant people out there with this Christopher Bendixson or, Hess McCook, Dan Held. It's like, you know, whatever topic, you know, related, all this FUD has already been discredited and debunked, you know, like so many times. like in this, you know, in the tiniest detail you can imagine, you know, would it be this whole energy flood or whatever? So, you know, it'll just take its own path. And I think, you know, the incentivization game is already on. And I think the proof is in the pudding, you know. I mean, look at Marty Bent with his Great American Mining. He just brought a really one of his best, if not the best, newsletter today. You should read. Have you read it already? Should subscribe. Yeah. And so he's talking, you know, like he's saying that, just paraphrasing, sort of, if, for example, the state of Wyoming, any other state, you know, goes like with full intention into Bitcoin mining and, you know, and uses all the resources and they can even, you know, alleviate somehow the tax burden on the people, or even maybe sort of have a UBI, you know. I mean, there's nothing against the UBI, but I think once we have like a hyper-Bitcoinization or a deflationary economy rooted in Bitcoin, I think people won't even need, you know, to waste so much energy and time thinking about investment or whatever, because it's a deflationary money. You know, it will just increase in purchasing power by order of magnitude. And finally, you know, we're going to have a money where people, you know, can, you know, take care of themselves and the families and their children, the children's children, without having, you know, to have a headache, you know, and saving is going to be, you know, not something, you know, that you're going to be crucified for according to the Keynesian economists. But it's mind-boggling. It's a total paradigm shift in thinking, in behavior, in psychology, emotional state of mind, in taking care of your future self, you know.
I agree. And I think the Austrian economists do a really great job of explaining the business cycle component, because we see it right now every day, to where people make poor investments when they think there's more of a safety net and a backstop than there really is. And when you extrapolate that over an entire economy, it's easy to see the waves in which this takes place. And when people finally grasp that, okay, resources are finite, money is finite, and so is our time, I think that people will be more careful about the choices they make and the opportunities they choose to pursue. Because we see a lot of interesting trends that come up. Say you want to make some sort of app. If it's a popular video game, then like a bunch of people rush in and coming up with copycat apps just because they see the opportunity. They think, oh, this is successful, I'll surely be successful as well, even though we're in very much a winner-take-all economy. And so I want people to be a little bit more careful and realize that, like, you know, the money that we have right now is completely a fugazi. And it's hopefully when we reunite our culture around just what it means to be fiscally solvent, so many of our problems will go away.
Do you know, or do you think that people who are, you know, who come in touch with Bitcoin, let's say for the first time, are aware of the, you know, of the second, third order effects, or what consequences it could have? Like, you know, we, you know, amongst Bitcoiners, libertarians, Austrians, we talk about, you know, separation of money and state. But I don't think people really understand what that really means in a positive way. Like, what kind of implications that have, or what kind of, you know, abundance. You know, you probably know, you've heard of Jeff Booth. I've had him on, you know, together with Titus Gebel of Free Private Cities. It was amazing talk, you know, and his book is just brilliant. Every, you know, 7-year-old child can understand what he's talking about. Do you think that people, I mean, have a at least an imagination when it comes to Bitcoin, like what kind of new world or new civilization we can have?
I think that's a great way of looking at when it comes to understanding Bitcoin, what the mountain is. Because I think a lot of people, they look at Bitcoin, they see it's a cryptocurrency, it lives on the internet, and they more or less think it's like, oh, it's kind of like some sort of video game currency. It's like rupees in Legend of Zelda. But in reality, I think what really makes it click for people is when they they understand the basic principles of it. Like, look, it's scarce. It's it can't be banned. It's decentralized. You could put it on a hard wallet and like forget about it in your closet for 100 years, and it'll still be there. And when people understand that, and they take a step back and see where it fits in the broader picture, that like there's a reason that it was designed in this way. That I think once you finally get that, that's when people start to grasp the second and third order effects of like, oh yeah, when we have this, they can't really, you know, keep borrowing and printing forever. I think it's kind of stupid, two-stage process.
You know, I just mentioned Free Private Cities, you know, from Titus Gebel, you know, his book also is called Free Private Cities. Have you ever like thought about what, because I think Marty Bent mentioned that in his latest newsletter today about a potential secession, you know, where a state, you know, would it be Wyoming, whatever, could secede from the federal government. Now let's not even go there. I'm just asking you, like, do you think we'll have sort of like citadels of free private cities or sort of localized economies, you know, everything rooted in Bitcoin, where, you know, actually, you know, the government has a role actually, you know, to serve, to protect property rights, security, and, you know, guarantee security and all of that. So do you think like private entrepreneurs, companies, you know, service providers could do this kind of, you know, take over this kind of role much cheaper, much more efficiently, and then have, you know, localized economy rooted in Bitcoin, and, you know, we'll have all our freedoms as an individual, as a sovereign individual?
I think that's it's an interesting concept. And I think that we're a ways from that, because obviously there's so much of the infrastructure that you don't really need on a Bitcoin standard, that a lot of the financial system is a waste. A lot of the insurance system is a waste. I feel like something like that's almost too hard to fathom, but you see a little bit of it kind of starting right now with states like Wyoming, states like Kentucky, which just passed that mining incentive law, to where the free market among states is already kind of bearing this out. And there will certainly be some laggards. The ones that are most steeped in this kind of borrow and print cycle, there's a reason people are leaving California for Texas type of scenario. And, but as far as, well, I mean, I suppose that makes sense, because there are certainly governments that get this more than others. And because I know there are governments like India that are talking about banning it. And meanwhile, America, we've always kind of relied on innovation, let it run wild. And if it's bad, then we'll rein it in. So I think maybe in like generations, we'll see entire governments that run on this stuff. And then maybe more like banana republic, unstable countries that are still struggling to get onto the Bitcoin standard, or maybe they just waited too long.
Mm-hmm. Now, with everything going on, you know, you talk about the central banks, you talk about, you know, the whole, it's very turbulent times right now, you know, I mean, socially, economically, it's a nightmare actually. So what I'm curious about, like, what's the sentiment around, you know, the people with, or, you know, the people that are friends, relatives, colleagues, whatever, what's the sentiment you're getting when it comes to Bitcoin?
The connection with Bitcoin. I think this particular cycle, people are starting to wake up to it a little more. That people have seen the headlines of it going, you know, 20x in basically 1 year. And that is resonating with people, because that's what's grabbing the attention. But I think on a deeper level, people understand something is wrong here, that the system is rigged in some way. And a lot of people are struggling to connect the dots. I've been trying to orange pill people a little bit, so to speak. And I think it's a tough thing to grasp what a sound money looks like when you've been addicted to fiat money for so long. But I think that little by little, people are grasping it. And we're seeing more and more adoption, more and more addresses on the blockchain every day. And it's just a slow and steady progress.
So it's become already mainstream. Do you have the impression? I mean, you know, we're so early. It's like 2% of the Earth's population are into Bitcoin, or we can't even call them like 100 million people like hodlers, but at least they're in one shape or another, they are into Bitcoin. So we're so early. And do you see like, you know, as to use Parker Lewis terminology again, you know, like gradually and suddenly a shift into, you know, like beyond mainstreaming, beyond like sort of a adoption rate taking place?
I think that I see that happening to where when the momentum reaches a critical mass, it just becomes hard to stop. And like a lot of things, like any sort of new trend in business or a gold rush, the masses love to jump in long after the upside is gone, so to speak. And I have no doubt that once we reach past a certain percentage of holders, that it's just unstoppable, to where it's I mean, when 10-20% of the Earth's population has it, I mean, it's in the news every day. It's in every single business publication. It's probably got its own spot on the CNBC ticker. It's just it doesn't even have to reach a majority, just a decent plurality or a sizable minority.
Half a billion people? Is that realistic?
Half a billion people.
Like with any other technology, John, like, people. You know, like if you think about, you know, mobile phones or whatever, Android or something like that, like, you know, once the half a billion tipping point was reached, I think it was really, it went like exponential. But, you know, just my guess.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially when you factor in Metcalfe's law. There becomes just a point where you can't stop it and you can't duplicate it. We see that all the time with some of the altcoins, to where they just say, hey, look, we're just where Bitcoin was in its first 6 months. We'll be the same one day. And it's just ridiculous. But it's hard to quantify what that number exactly is. And I'm not so much of an economist, but I mean, I think certainly within the next 2 or 3 years, we'll reach that number and things will take off.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen. It's going to be unexpected. Because I think even this year, there are some processes taking place. And I think we you know, our human brain, you know, like we talk about this a lot, is not really wired for, you know, for exponential functions or by order of magnitude, whatever process or developments that is, you know, whether that be the price. But, you know, I always tell people, don't think in fiat terms. You need to think in purchasing power. And I think people don't even have the slightest imagination what kind of purchasing power we're talking about, you know, with the absolute scarcity of Bitcoin, you know, and so has anything changed in your life, John? I mean, since you've come in touch with Bitcoin and now you're deep in the rabbit hole, you know, you're working on your book, and what has changed in your life since then?
I think I'm a lot more calm in general. I think I feel a lot more comfortable with my place in the universe. I think once I found Bitcoin, I think for the first time in a long time, I felt a sense of purpose. I think that's missing from a lot of people in my generation, because wages have stayed flat for so long. And I know at this point, my wife's probably tired of hearing about it. And so that's part of why I'm happy to start putting myself out there and meeting more Bitcoiners. It's been kind of a recent endeavor of mine. Once I left traditional newspaper journalism, I tried to stay relatively private, because covering politics, you've come across a lot of really interesting and sometimes shady characters. But I used to live the Anon life, but once I found this, I just kind of had to stand up and be counted, because I think it can fix so much, and it's made me a lot more confident. And I think I'm a more patient person as a result. Low time preference, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, it is true. And there's a lot of Bitcoinism, you know, amongst myself, you know, that do admit, you know, if it wasn't for Bitcoin, I think we all would be hopeless, if not even depressive, you know, because I think our civilization, this system, this matrix has come already so far ahead. You know, it's like people feel they have no control over anything. You know, they cannot influence anything or change anything, transform anything. So with Bitcoin, it goes like to the root, you know, to the essence of everything you can think of, you know, whether it be whatever, science, technology, art, culture, communication, empathy, you know, or just, you know, or just materialistic well-being, you know, or freedom, liberty, anything you can think of. Mm-hmm. So, John, anything you want to, before we wrap this up, anything you want to add, like that you think it's important to share with the audience, with my listeners?
I think I believe it's important to keep an open mind and to be patient with people. Something that I see a lot on Bitcoin Twitter is, you know, I think it's a function of where we are at in Bitcoin's journey. I mean, people, especially people that have been around for a long time, they're tired of shitcoiners and they're tired of, you know, people bringing up the same old FUD. But I think it's just a natural part of the process. People, I mean, let's be real. This Bitcoin is hard to grasp because it is just so revolutionary. And I think it's important to just be nice, yeah. Be patient, and have a low time preference.
Exactly. You know, I was trying to, I formed a group, you know, I tried to bring different well-known Bitcoiners together, and so we can make a film project. Already in touch, you know, with filmmakers, and he said, you know, he would even co-produce. But, you know, people want to do their own things. It's okay. Do you think there's something missing in the, what I'm trying to ask is like, do you think there's something missing in the, or something could be more helpful in communicating this vision, the comprehension, the knowledge, or, you know, anything that in order to make people understand what is Bitcoin really about? Would it be documentary, a movie, or whatever, something?
I think that something that can be helpful that I've started doing with people that I talk to is I think a lot of us, we love Bitcoin and we want to start right at Bitcoin. But in many ways, I think it can be helpful to start right at the problem. I think if you show people a chart of the M2 supply of the last 10, 15 years, and then show them what the wages have been for the last 10, 15 years. And I think immediately people will understand something is wrong. So I think framing it from a problem solution standpoint is a powerful way to get the narrative across.
Yeah. No, fair enough. Excellent closing words. So John, where can people find you? Are there any resources you want to direct my listeners to? And I hope you're going to come, you know, maybe in the future to a panel discussion on my show. And I'm sure you're going to be invited to other podcasts. Where can people find you? Any other, you know, information you want to share?
Yeah, I can be found on Twitter and LinkedIn. Twitter username is JTWriting21. There's not too many John Tinklenbergs out there, so I'm pretty easy to find. And I can also be found on Telegram as well, JTWriting21.
Yeah, so really enjoyed this conversation, John, and we'll stay in touch. And wish you really best luck for your book.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Okay.
This was fun. Bye, John. I enjoyed it.
Okay, that was a really fascinating conversation. I mean, I always love to talk with, you know, plebs or newcomers who are, you know, maybe since recently into the Bitcoin's rabbit hole. So make sure you follow John Tinklenberg or JT on Twitter, Telegram, or LinkedIn. And I hope, you know, he's going to come up with, publish his book sometime soon. And so we can have, you know, more discussions and more insights, more knowledge transfer. So yeah, make sure you follow me on Twitter. Subscribe, please, to my YouTube channel and to my podcast platforms. Podcast show, The Kevan Devani Connection. And I'll see you around. Thank you so much for listening.